As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Egypt podcast. This is an interview episode in which I speak to Professor Kara Cooney. Kara, or Kathleen Cooney, is a professor of Egyptian art and architecture at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. She is also the chair of the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at UCLA, and is active in both the academic and public archaeological communities. Professor Cooney specializes in several historical fields. Most notably, she investigates funerary practices in ancient Egyptian society. Under this umbrella, she examines funerary crafts and craftworking, tomb building, tomb robbery and reuse of sacred spaces, artistic trends, reception history, and patterns of change in ancient tastes. Kara also studies socio-economic systems and the structure of ancient Egyptian society. This is a small drop in the bucket of her work, but it is a major part of her academic research. Kara Cooney also works in the public field and is a well-known figure in television documentaries. She has published two trade books, one about Hatshepsut called The Woman Who Would Be King, and one about Egyptian royal women called When Women Ruled the World. Both books are available now, and you will find links in the episode description. I sat down with Professor Cooney to discuss a few things in Egypt's new kingdom. Firstly, we discussed funerary practices and crafts, and answered the age-old question, how much does an ancient Egyptian coffin cost? Then we moved into the reign of Hatshepsut specifically, and the impact she had on 18th dynasty royal power. Finally, we dove into questions about ancient Egyptian monarchy, and its relationship to organized crime. We also asked, if Kara Cooney could answer one question from ancient Egypt, what would it be? The interview jumped around a bit, but it breaks down into these three distinct sections. To keep everything smooth, I have divided the interview up into three separate parts. They are releasing one after the other, and I will also release the full version in one big episode for those who want it in one go. That's enough from me, on with the interview. Allow me to introduce Professor Kara Cooney. All right, so good morning, Professor Cooney. Thank you very much for joining us on the History of Egypt podcast, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How are things in Los Angeles? Are you doing all right?
Yeah, everything's great. It's beautiful and sunny outside of my office window, and we are all safer at home, our governor and mayor tells us, and I am teaching all of my classes via Zoom. And for the graduate class, that's been a joy because I'm doing a Diro Medina seminar, and we have Dr. Cedric Gobet taking part every week. And so whenever you have a question about Diro Medina, to have the lead archaeologist of the site of Diro Medina on the phone, on the Zoom call, it's amazing. So for the grad seminar, it's great. For the undergrad seminar of 200, it's a little more unwieldy, but we make it work. And I emote to a tiny camera in my computer, as so many other computers are doing all around the world.
That's exciting. That's a very good approach. That's a very cool approach. I like that. That's great. So, Professor Cooney, Kara, supposing you were at a cocktail party, someone asked you about your work, you know, that dreaded question. What would be your elevator pitch of the material that you specifically research and the questions you investigate?
Well, I'd have to pause and tell them that there are two of me, that I'm a bit schizophrenic as a educator, academic, communicator, and that I have two streams of research. One that I write under the name of Kathleen M. Cooney, that is highly data-based and text-based and social history examinations. And that would be my work on coffin reuse, my work on craftsmanship, apprenticeship, more art historical work. And then the other persona, the other side of me, I write under the name Kara Cooney, which is what everyone calls me, what my mother calls me, even though my birth certificate has Kathleen on it. And there, that's where I put my more risky, non-academic necessarily, though all grounded in academic work, pieces. And so that would be my trade books, like The Woman Who Would Be King and When Women Ruled the World. But I think everything shares, all of my work. So going back to your question, right? Going back to your question of the elevator pitch of what my work is about. I think a lot of my work starts with from an intuitive space, from working with the limited data that we have, but trying to create as full a picture as we can in the most responsible way, but not getting bogged down in the weeds and not arguing with colleagues over names and dates and facts, but more coming up above those weeds and asking why we should care at all and what it says about us, and trying to find more of an interchange of communication between the past and the present. And that's where I tend to go the most.
Okay. So perhaps broadly, would you say that you the root interest or the root questions you investigate are questions of humanity, human behavior, and depending on the context, you express them in perhaps two different languages and personalities?
I can almost sum it up in one word, how I like to approach humanity, and that is in terms of systems. Not a very sexy word, systems, but instead
it's on this podcast.
But you know, a student asked me today in the discussion for that big 200 person class, well, was Ramses II just insecure and that's why he built so many statues? And I'm like, no, you don't, that's not the way. He may have been, it's possible. He may not have been, he may have been completely non-insecure, you know, confident in every which way. But there's this question to ask, and it's not a useful way of looking at society. I like to look at social systems. So it's more useful to then ask, what kind of a social system would demand or allow that Ramses II place so many colossal statues all around Egypt in the places that, in the temple context that he did? And when you ask that, then you start to approach a picture of Ramses II that's not based on our description of the Temple of Abu Simbel, and he's the first one to divinize himself, and what does that even mean? And we go through all of the you know, discussions and the tomb of his sons and which son became king, and blah, 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 how many years in the said festivals. And you can do all of that. You can do it, and we should do it. But isn't it more interesting to then ask, well, it's not that he's insecure, but these statues get him something, and from whom? And why does he need to communicate with more people than the kings before him, than the 18th dynasty kings communicated with? Why does he need to communicate with a broader society, and what does that mean? And then you start to approach an understanding of the Ramessid period as one of royal populism, which I had never thought about until I started working on Ramses II for an article I'm doing and teaching this class. And now I'm thinking, if you look at it in that way, it's not about Ramses and how he feels or insecure or confident. It's about the social system that he is trying to key into. And then it becomes populism and how he tries to sow division within society and pit one part against another, how he tries to create an elite replacement and work towards the social mobility of the military and reward them while taking down other people. And then it becomes a much more interesting question for me, rather than the way these things have been focused upon. So then everything can be answered with systems. I teach another class on women in power in the ancient world at UCLA. And, you know, you'll always hit the part, and it's not just Egypt. I do Greece, Mesopotamia, China, the Levant, Persia, and Rome. And and when we're in the China part and you're talking about female, in India too, India or China, you have these ideas of infanticide of the female. And it, you know, people aren't doing this, I tell my students, because, you know, they're evil people who just like boys. when you look at why people do things like that, you want to approach it from the system. And if the system is so patriarchal that economic safety is only afforded through having many sons, then you will do as a family anything that you need to create that less anxious, that more risk-averse place for you and your family, even if that means killing a daughter again and again, and having even an entire population that's imbalanced towards sons. And so I just think now, and as I get older in my scholarship, I'm much more about the big picture, the long durée, the systems, than I am about the individuals. Now, that's not to say that I'm not super interested in biography at the same time. I love learning about people's lives and all of the trials and tribulations that they had. But the way that I focus on an individual's life is through their system. And thus, I think I get different things out of it than traditional Egyptology might.
Part two. With our introduction out of the way, Professor Cooney and I now move into the meat of things. We answer the age-old question, how much did an ancient Egyptian coffin cost?
So, narrowing the focus very slightly from that, you've researched many aspects of Egyptian social history, particularly relating to craftworking and funerary culture in the New Kingdom. Hypothetically, for an ancient person living in the social system of, say, Thebes during the late New Kingdom, someone looking ahead to the end of their life, their eventual burial, on some basic informational lines, how much, say, would a decent quality painted coffin cost an individual, and how long might these things take to prepare?
Yeah, a coffin can range in price. Your average coffin is going to cost about 30 deben, each deben equal to about 91 grams of copper. And that means nothing to us. We don't bring copper to the market. We don't even bring coins to the market anymore. So that can be compared to 30 deben, could be compared to a young cow. It could be compared to five shirts. Hand-woven shirts, of course. We don't get to go to the shop and buy these things. People are hand-weaving in their homes. And so, you know, five shirts, given how much time it must have taken to weave the linen for each of those shirts, that's the average price. And you can certainly go up from there to a coffin that costs 200 deben for just the one coffin. I'm not including the entire set. And so the coffin price itself makes you understand that very few people could afford these things. And it's funny, I work on price and value and social hierarchies, but as a dissertation writing grad student, it came as a shock to me to think that most ancient Egyptians wouldn't have had access to a coffin. And that it really, it's 5% or less. And those lower elites at the lower stratum of that 5% could afford a coffin that was quite awful to behold. And there are a few of those left in museums around the world or that show up on excavation sites. And when you see coffins that are so ugly and of such low quality wood and painting and everything, it fills me with great joy, because then I can see people in the lower part of society, elite society, trying to emulate what's higher up. And then I think about all of the people, the 95% of people who couldn't participate at all, who had a different, must have had a different way of reifying their death anxieties. They couldn't use the coffin to contain the deceased and transform them into Osiris or Re, not in that way. They had palm rib matting. They had other things. They would often bury the dead in a fetal position, not laid out, even though all of the rich were laid out. And this would happen in the New Kingdom and Third Intermediate Period and beyond. To think of all that we've missed, all of the funerary culture and the ways of burying the dead that we can only see in newly dug sites, because the excavators of the last 100 years have ignored so much of that material, unless it's very old, like the pre-dynastic. We've lost a lot. To think of what we have lost is it can be rather difficult for the archaeologist. But it's amazing to me how often we tell the story of the Egyptian preparation for burial uncritically through the lens of the rich, without any understanding of what we're doing. And then I think, oh my goodness, look at society today and how often we uncritically tell a story through the lens of the haves versus the have nots. And that is the way things run. And I always look at even funerary culture and preparation for it through a social history lens. So I'm in many ways more interested in the living than I am in the dead.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So speaking of the living, how did people's attitudes towards the dead, towards burials, and to the accessories that went along with that for poor and for non-poor, how did these sort of things change over the New Kingdom? Did practices or fashions shift? And what evidence do we have for this?
There's huge shifts, and it's there before our eyes in all of the excavations in a way that's so clear when you take the long durée approach, when you take a deep time approach. It's not even deep time. It's just a long duration of time, a good 300 years as you go from 17th dynasty burials in Thebes to early 22nd or 23rd or 24th dynasty burials in Thebes. Know what I'm saying in Thebes, because the preservation of this wood and of all of this material is largely a southern phenomenon. There are some coffins preserved from Tell el Amarna or from Saqqara or from some delta places, but not like they are in Thebes, and not with the consolidated material quality that they are in Thebes. Mm-hmm. And so this is very much a southern Egyptian question. So using that Theban material, you can see, one, that society broadens through time, that more people can participate towards the third intermediate period end than can participate on the 17th dynasty end. So there is a broadening of society, which is very interesting in and of itself. More people are there as decision makers, movers and shakers in the Theban society. More people are getting paid a wage and have something to say. Then the other trend that you see is of display. Display stays constant throughout. Families want to put their best foot forward. They want to show what they're able to produce, wealthy families. And that never stops. Even when people can't get access to wood to make a coffin in the 21st dynasty or starting in the mid 20th dynasty, they will reuse the coffin of their ancestors from a family crypt that they own legally, bring it to the craftsman and have it updated, because that need for display is so important. So even when there is an economic downturn, social competition and display drives a continuous production of coffins. It does not ever stop, which is interesting. It makes me think of human-induced climate change and people saying, you know, we should really use fossil fuels, less. And despite all of that, because of the system we have in place, because of how many people benefit from it, even though we know long-term we're walking towards a cliff or running, we continue to consume because of how much we get in the here and now. People don't like to change, and they only change when they absolutely have to change. There's no other recourse. They so often find another way. And then the third trend I would notice, and there are many other trends, but the third big trend is one of conspicuous consumption of commodities that anyone would want to use, towards a trend of conspicuous consumption of commodities in a more defensive manner. What I mean by that is in dynasties 17 and 18, and mainly 18, when you have the money to do this, people, rich people, are burying themselves with all kinds of things like shirts and sheets and blankets and beds and tables and chairs and wigs and unguents and makeup. And that's in addition to the coffins and the canopic jars and all of that paraphernalia for death with the coffin at the center. So all of this stuff. And then as the New Kingdom starts to go down this downward spiral and things start to fail and tombs are open and these commodities are pulled out, the Egyptian Thebans, and it must have been happening in Saqqara and other places in the world, start to think about their burials in a much more defensive fashion. And they then resist the urge for the conspicuous consumption of stuff that others would love to have, and towards the conspicuous consumption of stuff that is problematic to take, problematic to reuse. If you go into someone's tomb and you don't touch their coffin, but you take all this nice big stack of woven linen sheets, then you're like, oh, they don't need the sheets. I can tell the dead people aren't using it. Whatever, those silly people, I'm taking the sheets. And the dead person, like, sorry, dead person, all good, we're fine. But in time goes on, so people are like, fine, I'm not going to bury myself with sheets. I'm just going to bury myself with the coffin, with the nested coffin set, with the canopic jars, with all of the things that you need for death. And I am dispensing with all of that daily life material. You actually see it in tomb depictions at the same time, interestingly. You see in the tomb chapel, above which all of this stuff is buried in an 18th dynasty tomb, images of weeping, images of potting, images of metallurgy, all of these things. People want to consume that and display that. By the time you get to the Ramessid period, 19th and 20th dynasties, people are like, no, we're not doing that anymore. It's not helpful. And everyone's taken my stuff, or because I'm the one that took it. So then they start to defensively think, I am going to focus on the commodities that are harder to take. And so in the 19th dynasty, they're tricking out their coffins, they're gilding their coffins. Mummification is arguably better in dynasty 19. And you have an explosion of different kinds of objects that are much more religiously purposed. And so when the crisis really hits in dynasty 20, mid-dynasty 20, but it could have hit earlier for many people, and people are like, oh my God, we need the wood to bury grandma, you know, otherwise she's not going to be transformed. And what do we do? What will people think? Then they'll even reuse those religiously functional commodities and go for the coffins, go for canopic jars, reuse things that had a kind of force field around them, a social force field, because people don't want to reuse something that was meant for the dead that may have the detritus of the dead body on it. And so they pull away from that. By the time the crisis gets really bad in Dynasty 21, this is just normal. It's so normal to reuse a coffin that in some coffins, there's one coffin in the Vatican and another coffin in the Met that probably are a mother-daughter reuse. The mother had the coffin and the daughter keeps the mother's name on there and then put her name over the varnish. You can prove it in the Met because there's a papyrus in association with it that names them both and their relationship to each other. The coffin in the Vatican only has two strange Libyan names that helps me to circumstantially suspect that these women were related to each other. And the retention of one name was not scribal error. These are people doing something purposefully. So the trends are there for how people deal with burial, but isn't it great? It's not just burial. It's everything. It is the way people, rich people, had themselves buried, but it is reflective of so much more within Egyptian society, what the economic health of the place was, how many people were integrated into government systems, how people displayed to make their mark in a particular time and place. And the only thing that is constant within that changing data set is the need for the rich people to display. And it's something that still hasn't changed in many ways. We need to see and touch the dead as they go into the ground. And as we're here in this coronavirus pandemic and so many people are losing family members and they are buried without anyone being there or cremated without anyone having said goodbye, these are things that we find very problematic, we human beings. But we do like to put on a good show and display and show how important our family members are. And so that even the Quran, when it says, probably in reaction to many of these polytheistic traditions of using death ceremonies to put a family up on a pedestal. Even in the Quran, when it says, you know, everyone, rich and poor, is buried simply 3 days right into the earth, no, nothing else. Then you'll go to Cairo, or you'll go to Istanbul, or you'll go anywhere where Islam has been practiced for centuries, and you'll see these grand burials, and you think, well, this is a cheat. And it is a cheat. The person is still put into the ground, directly into the earth, So they did it, but it's got all this marble and beautiful stuff all around it. And so we don't like to give up these methods of display.
We find the loopholes in the system.
Always do.
You have to be in the ground in 3 days, but there's nothing that stops you from building a mausoleum 3 years ahead.
Yeah.
My conversation with Kara continues after the break. First, we have to get that automated advertising out of the way. See you in a moment.
Was the Sphinx 10,000 years old?
Were there serial killers in ancient Greece and Rome?
What were the lives of transgender, intersex, and non-binary people like in the ancient world?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. We tell you true stories and tall tales of the ancient world. Sometimes we do it tipsy. Sometimes we have amazing guests on our show. Historians like Barry Strauss, podcasters like Liv Albert, Mike Duncan, and authors like Joanne Harris and Ben Aronovich.
We take you to the top of Hadrian's Wall to watch the Roman Empire fall at the end of the world.
We walk the catacombs beneath the Temple of the Feathered Serpent under Teotihuacan.
We walk the sacred spirals of the Nazca Lines in search of ancient secrets.
And we explore mythology from ancient cultures around the world.
Come find us at ancienthistoryfangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Part 3. Finally, we move into the realm of craftsmanship. Specifically, how did an ancient coffin maker learn their trade?
So, looking at the actual production of these objects, you know, for every coffin, there is a maker, someone who has to carve and decorate and produce this thing. Artisans obviously didn't appear fully formed and skilled out of nothing. They went through apprenticeships with many stages of learning. And this is something that you have also researched. What evidence do we have for ancient Egyptian apprentices specifically?
Hardly any. It's really tricky to study something like this. You're not going to find a school. You're not going to find even clearly marked father-son pairings. In terms of craftsmanship, there are two main places to really focus your study, and that is either Tell el Amarna or it is Deir el-Medina. And those two places are invaluable capsule cities. One, Deir el-Medina, a manufactured non-organic village in the desert that shouldn't exist and that water has to be brought to physically. Thus that desert place, it caps it and secures it for us to study. And Amarna, this manufactured city built from the ground up, about a 10-year history, right? And then they abandon it and it's capped and sealed for us to study. So using those two places, the documentation, even though there are tons of ostraca that talk about the prices of different commodities, the crew at Deir el-Medina, an ostracon, by the way, is a limestone flake or a potsherd flake with text or image on it. And these ostraca tell us all kinds of things about craftsmanship, about how much things cost, about who's doing work, who the work is for, whether the work is state employment or private sector employment, arguably, though that's a tricky question. But nowhere do you see anybody talking about training their son in their profession. You do see genealogically that sons can often follow fathers, and you can follow the genealogy at Deir el-Medina and see how people are moving into the crew to build and decorate these tombs in the Valley of the Kings and Valley of the Queens. But how much this was a question of status and payoffs versus skill level is very debatable. So you're left with all kinds of weird circumstantial arguments that you have to try to make from what's left behind. And I'll give you two little things that I have used to try to understand apprenticeship, two pieces of data. One is the coffin of Senegem, today in the Cairo Museum, found in Theban Tomb 1, the only intact Ramessid tomb from Egypt, Theban, of course. And that coffin of Senegem has beautiful decoration on one side with the text in blue ink. And then on the other side, on the coffin case side, that blue is inexpertly applied to the coffin. It's almost like the apprentice did it, somebody who didn't know what they were doing. And the hieroglyphs just look really messy and it doesn't look very nice. And you can look at that coffin and you can just circumstantially guess this is a master and apprentice situation. And they actually let the apprentice keep his hand, his inexpert hand of lower value on the coffin, and that everyone saw that displayed and that that was okay. That in some cases, that inexpert hand was allowed to be kept on a given piece. You don't see it very often. And you wonder if it was a conscious choice, because most other coffins that we have preserved have a more a higher quality hand and a more rigorous eye to consistency on a piece. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that stood. Maybe because they're craftsmen, this Sinegem family, a family of craftsmen, maybe they allowed one of the apprentices in their family, allowed his hand to stay on that coffin. It's completely possible that the father's like, no, I want it. I love it. It stays. Who knows? We have no idea. That's an interesting point. And so you can see it, but you don't know the details. And then there's some of the work that I've done on figural ostraca. These limestone flakes and potsherds that have figures on them rather than text, or figures in addition to text. And they can be anything. They can be sketches of a monkey climbing a tree, or a pharaoh's profile, or it can be something a little more formal, a sketch of a kind of stela of somebody worshiping a god or goddess with names attached to it. And these figured ostraca, you know, we Egyptologists, we Westerners, most of us, have tried to find a common use for these figured ostraca, and to say, oh, these pieces are trial pieces for a tomb. And people have looked and they're like, no, that doesn't really work. What you see in the Valley of the Kings is very different from what's depicted on these figural ostraca, or what you see depicted in the tomb chapels or burial chambers that are painted of Dira Medina workmen, also very different. So there's not an overlap. It's not a trial piece. It doesn't really work. And then some of these sketches are very unusual. A dancing woman. Some of them are masterful and extraordinary, and some of them are really ugly. And so you get an idea of how this works. And instead of calling it an apprenticeship system, I like to call it a community of practice, which is not something that I've come up with. This is a system developed by Lave and Wenger, I think, are the anthropologists or cognitive scientists who have developed this idea that if you have a community and there's a shared practice in that community, then everyone is in this community of practice and they're all competing and cooperating and working with each other and showing off and hiding and doing all of the things that you would do in a community of practice. And so while it's easy for us to think of a Da Vinci workshop, master, apprentice kind of system, because that's what we have in our Western brains, when you look at the way people actually teach people how to do something, how a mother might teach her daughters to bake bread, it's always her daughters, right? Whatever we want it to be. Maybe there are young sons around, but maybe he's being apprenticed in a different way. But when she's doing that, and the grandmother's there, maybe the aunt's there, it is a community of practice that girl is brought into for something, bread baking, that demands a tremendous amount of skill. I can't bake bread at all. It's a disaster. And I'm not even trying despite coronavirus. But, but you know, you have this constant practice going on that is training you. And I think very much the same thing was going on at Dira Medina, but not in the way we expect, not where you sit children down again during this coronavirus pandemic and you see what homeschooling is and what the teachers give you in another worksheet. I have a 10-year-old, and God's help us. This kind of rote repetition, this way we think of it that is proper learning. There are many ways of learning how to do something, and just including your child in your life and having that child be a part of your actual work. It would probably be better for most of the kids who are at home right now than all those stupid worksheets we're making them do. But we can't let go of that idea that that's what real education is. But these ostraca, these figured ostraca, give a bit of an idea that everyone was constantly practicing. Everyone was constantly messing with their figures. Everyone was showing off. Some of them had amazing hands. The master is painting. Some of them are just like, oh my goodness, what is that? And it's some kid who's showing what he can do. And he's got his hands on an ostracon. And everyone's like, ha ha, cute. And then he throws it down.
Running up and like, mummy, mummy, look what I drew.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe. Yeah. Or maybe they're all up in the huts over by the Valley of the Kings and everyone's hanging out overnight. They're not going to go back. Guards don't want to let them go back, something. So they're all just sketching and laughing. And there's a pornographic one. And there's a, you know, one of the monkey climbing the trees because they miss the trees and they live out in the desert. But I see it in a much more free form way, much more organic, much more messy than we like to see. And I think that's one of the reasons we haven't identified schools, because the schools don't exist in the way that we think they do. They're everywhere and everyone's doing it. So that's a very long answer to your
question. Model, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yep. That's interesting. And off the record, that community of practice thing, did you say it was Lave and Winger?
Mm-hmm.
Lave and Winger. That sounds fascinating, because my PhD research is on socioeconomics of Dynasty 18, so I need to find that. That's a very interesting idea. Thank you.
My graduate
student. You don't happen to have the reference, do you?
I do, and I have it somewhere in this office. And I'll make sure that, where is it, or is it at work? I'll send it to you, though. There it is. Here it is. I knew to look for the yellow. Yeah. Is it backwards or can you see it?
Situated learning. Okay. Just hopefully my library has that. But situated learning. I'll just take a quick screenshot of that, actually. That's useful. That's an excellent little thing. Thank you very much.
A lot of my grad students find this extraordinarily useful, and it can work for anything. So if you're talking, I have one graduate student finishing right now, Danny Candelora, who's working on military communities of practice. And then you have different military communities of practice coming into contact with one another, like 11-team chariot-based, more competitive community of military practice coming into contact with an infantry-based, non-chariot, less competitive, more draft labor kind of community of practice. And when those two come together, you get some very interesting results.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting, because, yes, we're very, in the West, at least today, we are very stuck in a Victorian model of education. But yes, as you're right, you know, in the basic structures of human society, this is a very good way to teach your children, is just have them watch, have them test it alongside you, or do it. Even if it's just to keep them busy and stop them nagging you.
Yeah, there's less beating, there's less cajoling, there's less of a demand that they do something that they don't want to do. Those kids want to be with you and do something with you. And it's interesting to see how I think we have so much of this wrong.
I agree.
At this point in the conversation, Professor Cooney and I move to the reign of Hatshepsut. You will find that in the next interview episode, releasing very shortly. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you soon. Take care.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.